to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
How's the money get to Wall Street? We talk about they have this enormous casino, but how's the money get into the casino? Whose money are they playing with? Where does it come from? This financial strip mining was so effective that by 2006, 40% of all corporate profits ended up on Wall Street, even though Wall Street only has 5% of the workforce. That's the kind of transfer that took place. They literally had a suction hose inside these companies. So the funny money to play in the casino, in fact, is the strip mine money.
That's our guest today, Les Leopold, on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Welcome and Happy New Year to you. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. We start off the new year with a thoroughly engaging interview about the reasons for the seemingly unstoppable trend of economic inequality here in the U.S. as we suit up for a year of getting a grip on how to deal with Wall Street's occupation of our government and our every shred of personal finance. And we get ready for a year of exciting developments in the public banking world. Matt Stannard will be along in a few minutes with a quick reexamination of our relationship with money. But we start out with a chat with Ellen, who caused a stir this recent week with a provocative article about the new practice of confiscating people's money from their bank accounts to pay off the bad debts of banks gone bad.
Your article last week, titled, A Crisis Bigger Than ISIS, why characterize it with such an extreme example of crises?
What prompted my article was that there was a pensioner in Italy who hanged himself after losing 100,000 euros in his bank, where he had banked for 50 years. He had actually bought bank bonds and lost the whole thing in a bail-in. So bail-ins have started in Europe. And according to the prime minister, the reason they did the bail-ins then, this is November of 2015, the reason they did the bail-ins then was that on January 1st of this year, like now, they will be bailing in the depositors' money as well. So it's theoretically the depositors' money that's uninsured, so that's everything over 100,000 euros. But when they did the banking union, they agreed on bail-in. In other words, you had to bail in your creditors' money or take your creditors' money, which included the depositors' money, before you could do a bailout by tapping into these funds that are put together by the member banks and by the governments. But they didn't agree to a Eurozone-wide insurance scheme. They couldn't agree to that. So if you're insured, it's only by your local fund, whatever the insurance fund is for your country. So if you're in Greece or one of these governments that are struggling, the money may not be there to cover the deposits. So you could still get wiped out even if you're an insured depositor. And the uninsured depositors, 100,000 euros is not that much for, say, a business. Many businesses keep more than that in the bank because they need to meet payroll, they need to pay suppliers and so forth. You know, they have cash flow that's going on all the time. And that's what happened in Cyprus when they had the original Cyprus bail-in, which was the shot across the bow and showed what they were up to with the financial stability board and the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland and in our Dodd-Frank Act and so forth. In the original Cyprus bail-in, it was the businesses that got hit the worst. They would have more than 100,000 euros in the bank, so they lost half their money. So either they were laying off workers and downsizing, or they went bankrupt altogether. So it's very hard on the local economy, and a lot of people lost their jobs and so forth. So this Italian prime minister said the reason he did the bail-in of these four local banks, they weren't even too big to fail, systemically risky banks, but local banks, was that if he had waited till January, it would have affected millions of savers. So he said sacrifice 1 million savers and the jobs of nearly 6,000 people. So it's going to be worse starting in January in Europe, and there are a lot of banks that are quite vulnerable in Europe, supposedly. But in the U.S., we are actually more vulnerable to a derivatives collapse because under the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010 and the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005, derivatives go first in a bankruptcy. A bank bankruptcy is no longer what it used to be. The bank doesn't go bankrupt, one of the sci-fis, the too big to fail banks. They don't go bankrupt. It used to be that when a bank couldn't pay its creditors, that the bank would be put into bankruptcy. You'd sell off the assets and pay the creditors. But now the creditors have to pay so that the bank can stay in business. And the derivatives claimants go first in a bankruptcy, and that's trillions of dollars of liability. There's actually $247 trillion in notional value of derivatives of the five biggest U.S. banks, the big derivative banks. And the FDIC fund only has $67 billion in it right now. They do have a credit line for $500 billion with the Treasury, but that's just a loan, and who would pay that loan back? So we're very vulnerable because of these derivatives.
Is there any prospect of reversing this provision that allows derivatives to go first?
Well, the problem is that the banks pretty much own Congress, as has been said. So how do we overcome that, that they've got all the money to pay these lobbyists who then persuade the legislators to do their bidding? And they do it in these gigantic bills that nobody can read. And unless you have somebody like Elizabeth Warren who's really peering closely, we wouldn't even hear about these things that are slipped in there. Mm-hmm. So it looks to me like our solution is to set up our own system, step out of that system, set up our own publicly owned banks. Right. Or there are other options, too. People are talking about community banking systems or digital systems that are on the model of Bitcoin, that sort of thing. Anyway, we need to step out of that system, pull your deposits out for starters, or at least don't keep a lot of money in any one bank or in the biggest banks. So there's really no really safe place, and that's why I think we need to set up publicly owned banks which are safe, backed by the state or backed by a city with some resources.
So that's why she called it a crisis bigger than ISIS, because it could affect a majority of us who rely on the central institution of banking to preserve our operational place in the world of personal assets. To read this and other articles by Ellen, go to ellenbrown.com. We'll be back in a few minutes with Ellen and this week's special guest, Les Leopold, to take a fascinating look into the mechanics and the dynamics of economic inequality in a special full-length interview. So stay tuned.
I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report. Voltaire said, "It's easier to write about money than it is to obtain it," and I certainly know how that feels. There's an uncanny consistency in quotations about money, but before we go there, let's get something straight. There's this long quote reportedly attributed to Thomas Jefferson, because, hey, Thomas Jefferson says all kinds of things, but this is a quote about banks, and it's a partially false one. The purported line is that banking power will make the American people homeless on the continent their fathers conquered because banks are more powerful than standing armies, etc., etc., and whatnot. In fact, the part of the quote about homelessness hasn't been found anywhere in Jefferson's writings, and experts say that it's spurious. The alleged quote even contains words like inflation and deflation that weren't really in style until after Jefferson's timeline. Jefferson did say in a letter to John Taylor in 1816 that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, which is a pretty immortal quote in itself, but the embellished version continues to travel unabated. As Abraham Lincoln once said, always double-check what you read on the internet. But we all know banks can be more dangerous than armies. Big banks often fund armies of various sorts. What can we learn from more precise quotes about banking? Well, as I said, the thematic pattern is uncannily consistent. And the theme? Well, it's that banks create money, and that money is largely a power-laden artificial creation. Does that seem like an arcane secret, that banks create money? Take this quip from John Kenneth Galbraith in Money, Whence It Came, Where It Went. The process, he writes, by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled. The great inventor Thomas Edison also saw through the ruse. He said in 1921, "It is absurd to say that our country can issue $30 million in bonds and not $30 million in currency. Both are promises to pay, but one promise fattens the usurers and the other helps the people." The economist Ralph George Hawtrey explained the process a little more succinctly in 1919. By its means, the banker creates the means of payment out of nothing, whereas when he receives a bag of money from his customer, one means of payment, a bank credit, is merely substituted for another, an equal amount of cash. And if that wasn't clear enough, the acerbic economics writer Lawrence Lee Baisley Angus wrote curtly in 1937 that the modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing, and the process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand that was ever invented. In fact, it was not invented, it merely grew. Banks, in fact, are able to create and cancel modern deposit money just as much as they were able to create or call in their own original forms of private notes. They can, in fact, inflate and deflate, i.e. mint and unmint, the modern ledger entry currency. And who knows this better than economists and scholars of the Federal Reserve System? There was a time when they would say it outright, as in this position from Dorothy Nichols of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago back in 1961. The actual process, she writes, of money creation takes place in commercial banks. As noted earlier, demand liabilities of commercial banks are money. Confidence in these forms of money also seem to be tied in some way to the fact that assets exist on the books of the government and the banks equal to the amount of money outstanding, even though most of the assets themselves are no more than pieces of paper. And another Federal Reserve writer, David Friedman of the New York Fed, said it again in 1977. Commercial banks create checkbook money whenever they grant a loan, simply by adding new deposit dollars in accounts on their books in exchange for a borrower's IOU. And this from Bernard Leiter, an economist and one of the designers of the euro. Quite simply, money is created when banks lend it into existence. Do you ever get the feeling that there's a big secret going on that really isn't a secret at all? My personal favorite money quote is from the late, great Douglas Adams in the introduction to his immortal work, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movement of small green pieces of paper, which was odd, because on the whole, it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. I'm Matt Stannard. Don't panic. It's our money.
My guest today is Les Leopold, co-founder and director of the Labor Institute in New York City and the author of many books. His latest book just came out in October and is called Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. It's great to be talking to you, Les.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you present some shocking facts in your latest book, like in your other books, but your concern in your work and your writings isn't just in alarming us with facts, but in presenting solutions, which is what I also try to do. So I want to get into all that, but first, by way of background, can you explain what you do at the Labor Institute and how you got into this line of work?
Yeah, I've been there since we started in 1976, believe it or not. I'm totally unfit for any other kind of work. We design educational programs for trade unions, worker centers, community organizations on health and safety, the environment, and economics. And I've been fortunate to be supported by the Institute to write books as well. And our fundamental goal is doing what we can to build a progressive movement in the United States to fight the financialization of the economy, all the good issues you're working on, and what we consider the core feature, which is runaway inequality.
Yeah, I agree. That's what we need to do, all get together. As you write, we have all these silos, separate silos of groups working for different things, but nobody has the power to really change things. But if we all got together, the 99% obviously outnumbers 1%, but we need to be organized. In your latest book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice, you write that economic inequality is our most critical economic issue today and that it is worse than we think. How bad is it?
It's bad. Let me start by saying that there's interesting poll data of the American public about how bad they think the gap is. When polled a year or two ago, basically they thought it was somewhere between 40 to 60 to 1, 40 for a top CEO, well, $40 for that person versus $1 for the average worker, which is actually very interesting because that's what it was in 1970. It was actually 45 to 1. If you think about that in slightly different terms, it means that if the average worker could afford a car in 1970, then a CEO could afford 45 cars. If an average worker could afford a home, a CEO of a top 100 company could afford 45 homes. Well, it's gone up a little since then. In 2013, it was 829 to 1. And actually, we just got the latest numbers. We just put them together for 2014. It was 844 to 1. One car for the average worker, 844 cars for the top CEO.
Wow.
And if the average worker could afford two cars for their family, you're talking about almost 1,700.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a huge gap.
Where would you put all those cars?
Yeah, really.
Which is another issue. Like, who's going to buy all these things? If the wealthy have all the money, they're not going to buy the consumer goods.
Well, there's definitely a demand problem, and that's why we're in a situation of deflation virtually at the moment. I want to jump right to one of the key takeaways of the book, which is the runaway inequality is not going to fix itself. There's no magic pendulum in the economy that swings back and forth between more and less inequality. It's a question of fundamental policy, and the policies that we have put in place for the last generation and longer have promoted runaway inequality and have built it into the economy. So, for example, since we're supposedly in the middle of a recovery that began in 2008, so that we've had 7 years of recovery. 95% of all the new income generated has gone to the top 1%. 95% of all the new income generated. So that means runaway inequality is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no magic mechanism. You know, the economy is not like this machine that just swings back and forth. It's guided, as you well know, by public policies. And when the public policies are aimed at to produce runaway inequality, although they were sold to us differently, then you're going to get it. But the second takeaway is we have to build a very big movement focused on dealing with the fundamental causes of runaway inequality, which I think, and which the book makes the case, comes from this unholy alliance between Wall Street, basically, and the financialized corporation now presided by the top CEOs. They are strip mining our economy, moving wealth away from everyday people into the coffers of the top fraction of 1%. And we have to do something about it. I think we can, but it's going to require a combination of really good education and really good organizing.
Mm-hmm. That term, financial strip mining, is a great metaphor and very colorful. Can you explain how that works?
Well, if it's okay, let me take this back kind of from the get-go. From World War II till today, productivity in America, the amount of goods produced per hour of labor, has risen year after year after year. It's risen in 59 of the last 65 years, and in the years that it hasn't gone up, it's either been flat or down by a tiny little fraction of a percent. We produce roughly three times as much per hour of labor as we did back then, and we have a much bigger population. So we're producing an enormous amount of goods and services. Well, from 1947 to the mid-1970s, every time productivity went up, so did the average real wage of the non-supervisory and production worker, which is about 85% of the entire workforce. And I'm talking about real wages after accounting for inflation. And the standard of living for most working people went up. Even those who were on the margins of society and were starting to get into society were seeing increases. African-American workers were seeing increases. Women in the workforce were seeing increases. Although there were big gaps, everyone more or less was seeing an increase in their standard of living. I saw it in my own family, my working-class family. My parents were doing a little better each year. By the time my sister went to a public college, she's older than I was. By the time I went to college, they could afford to, contribute some to go to a private college. Something was happening. I was in graduate school in the early 1970s. They taught us this was an iron law, that when productivity went up, so did the average real wage. Then all of a sudden, I graduated and somebody repeals the law. By the end of the 1970s, the two lines had pulled apart. and productivity continues to go up and up and up, and real wages actually have gone down since the mid-1970s. The average working person has not had a real wage increase since 1977. So the question becomes, why? What happened? That's kind of our story. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was there was a kind of a corporate elite revolt against the turmoil of the 1960s and 1970s, and they felt that capitalism was under threat, that people like Ralph Nader were destroying it, that students and their lefty professors on campus were calling for socialism, and a guy named Lewis Powell, who became a Supreme Court justice, wrote a famous memo about how corporations had to get aggressive and basically take back the country and set up these think tanks and speakers bureaus, and out of that came, you know, Free Enterprise Institute, the Manhattan Institute, Cato Institute, you know, all those kinds of institutes on the right were developed. And out of that process came what we call the Better Business Climate Model. Academics would call it neoliberalism, but in the book we use a term I think that's more accessible and less confusing. And the Chicago School of Economics, Milton Friedman, were popularizing this. He had a TV show in the 1970s about this. And it was basically to get a vibrant free enterprise economy that would create prosperity for all, you need to cut taxes, especially on the wealthy, so there'd be more incentive for them to go out and do great new things, cut back government regulation, get the government out of the economy as much as possible, deregulate everything that you can deregulate, and cut back on social safety net, support for unions, and things like that, where people felt that they were entitled to get something for free. All that was supposed to create a huge investment and profits boom, and then all boats would rise. Well, what happened as a result of that model was the dirty little secret that Milton Friedman and others didn't talk about, I'm not sure they were totally aware of it, was that when the deregulation of the goods and services sector, like telephone, trucking, airlines, that's very different than deregulating Wall Street. I don't have to tell you this, but it's very, very different. And they deregulated Wall Street with a ferocity that I think no one anticipated. And doing so set in motion a series of events that finally culminated in the crash of 2007, but still going on. And this changed the nature, I believe, of American capitalism. And I'll give you one critical change that happened. I mean, there's a whole bunch. Of course, we can talk about Glass-Steagall and not being deregulating derivatives and encouraging or, you know, allowing these large banking formations to form, all that kind of stuff. That's in the popular press. But I started reading this work by an economist named William Lozanek, who's sort of an institutional economist. He comes at this a completely different way. He really tries to figure out, well, what actually changed in corporate America. And he points to this 1982 SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, ruling. President Reagan, and he wasn't the only one that was buying this Better Business Climate Model, by the way. Let me just say that both political parties bought it and continue to buy it. I think Bernie Sanders is about the only one that doesn't buy it to some extent, you know, where the private sector is holy, public jobs are bad, private jobs are good, we have to create a better business climate model, et cetera. Well, Reagan was, of course, a big proponent of this. So he appointed a guy who was the head of E.F. Hutton, which was a big financial firm at the time, who becomes head of the Securities Exchange Commission. And he changes a rule, which up until that point, it was virtually illegal for a company to buy back its own shares. And the reason it was illegal, I think, was obvious to everybody previously to that, which is companies could then manipulate the price of their stock. And that would be stock manipulation, the kind of manipulations that led to the crash of 1929. And the reason the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was founded in the 30s, eliminated that or set up this harsh rule that prohibited stock buybacks was that they thought it was stock manipulation. Well, this guy came in with the Chicago
School. Can I stop you? So, would they manipulate the stock?
Ah, about to get to that. Great. Thank you for asking. For many people, we find in our workshops that we do this is a difficult concept. But imagine it this way. Let's imagine you and I own a $1 million company, and we have equal shares, one share each. Your share is worth $500,000. My share is worth $500,000. I decide to buy you out. So now there's one share left. That share is worth $1 million now because there's one less owner. Well, this works for large numbers of owners. If you reduce the number of owners by buying back your own shares, you literally retire those shares. So now there's, you know, instead of a million owners, there might be 900,000 owners. Well, every one of those shares, all things being equal, is worth a little more. The revenues are still the same, so the earnings per share is going to be higher. So the price of the share goes up. So when you go in the marketplace to buy back your own shares, you drive up the price of the remaining shares by reducing their number. So that's why it was considered stock manipulation. So if a company goes in there and buys a lot of shares at once or over a period of time, it can push up the value of it, of its own stock. Mm-hmm. All right, so big deal. If you ask a CEO or a board why they do this, they say, well, with the best of that, our shares were just a better use of funds than we believe in our company. It's a better use of funds than other things we could have done with it. So that's why we did it. It was a very sound investment. Well, here's what really happened. Before 1982, CEOs were paid 95% in salaries and bonuses and 5% in stock incentives. Today, only 5% of a CEO's pay are salary and bonuses. All the rest are stock incentives.
Wow.
Now, why would that be? Well, think about it. Now, what would you do? You're a CEO, and your 95% of your pay are stock incentives. What would you do? Well, of course, you'd do everything you could do to drive up the value of the shares. Now, why did that compensation change? So there's all this pressure on the stock price. Well, what changed was when deregulation set in the late 70s, early 1980s, and then beyond, the whole process of corporate rating became more or less legalized. Investors, corporate raters, we now call them hedge funds, private equity companies, take a little bit of their own funds, borrow a huge amount, and buy up companies. And then they do a very interesting phenomenon. They stick the debt on the company. It would be as if you went out and took a loan to buy a car, and then your car pays back the loan, not you. So the investors don't pay back the loan. The company they bought pays back the loan. And, of course, right off the top, they take a special dividend, so they almost come out even right away. And they change the nature of the way CEO gets paid, because the CEO becomes basically the straw boss for these huge investors that came in to take these positions in companies.
Wow.
So what do they demand? And the paper is full of this. Now, I think if you start looking for this, you'll find it again and again. You'll hear, so-and-so hedge fund takes a big position in company X, pharmaceutical company. And what do they demand? They demand that the company use its revenues to buy back its own shares to drive up the price. They want the money returned to the investor. So you have this wonderful, unholy alliance between, wonderful from the hedge fund's point of view, of the corporate raider and the CEO working in tandem to drive up the price of the stock. Now, this is the startling point. This is the factoid. By the way, there's 101 charts in this book, or at least 101, all easy to read, all coming at runaway inequality from different angles. And here's the one that there are two I'm going to go over now, but this is the one that kind of blew my mind. In 1980, the percent of profits that were used to buy back the company's own shares was zero. Oh, man, maybe it was 2%. By 2006, it was 75%.
Wow.
75% of all corporate profits went not to reinvest in the company, not to pay decent wages and benefits. It went to buy back their own shares to drive up the price of the share so the CEO, who knows exactly when their options kick in and whatnot, can cash out, make a fund bundle, and of course the hedge funds figure this out as well, and they know how to jump in and jump out and make their bundle. Now, what happens when you run out of profits? What do? Well, you've used up, because you throw in dividends, the companies that pay dividends, you're over 100%. We're talking now about not just the top 100 companies. We're talking about the top 500 companies. They're up to 75%. They're over 100% when you throw in dividends. What do they do next? They borrow more money. They put more money, more debt on top of the company to buy back even more shares. So this is what we call financial strip mining. How do they pay for all this? Well, they outsource. They move jobs overseas. They get rid of product lines that aren't producing enough cash flow. They cut back on wages and benefits. They bust the union. If they need to, they'll use bankruptcy to further get rid of some debt and further get rid of union contracts. They eliminate defined pension plans and move towards 401ks or no pensions at all. They do all the downward pressure we see, all this conversation we're having about, whoa, what happened to middle-class jobs? That's what happened to middle-class jobs. They vaporize them in the strip mining process to put money into their own pockets. And they're doing this every single day. Let me give you one egregious example that I find personally appalling. You know, we bailed out General Motors, and the unions took a huge cut in their pay for new workers, would be paid half as much as the old workers. They took all kinds of cutbacks in the process. And the company got on its feet again. I think that bailing it out was the right thing to do because it was crashing due to no fault of its own. It was due to the financial system falling apart due to reckless Wall Street behaviors, which was a direct result from this better business climate. Full circle. Anyway, so GM's on its feet again and now has about a $25 billion cash cushion. Now, as one of the taxpayers that helped bail out GM, I want GM to invest every penny it can into building the best environmentally friendly cars that it could possibly build, raise its miles per gallon, you know, develop electric, hydrogen, whatever it takes to protect the environment. That's what I think most taxpayers would want GM to do. Now, This is the appalling part. The guy who engineered the bailout, negotiated in behalf of the Obama administration, left after he did his work there and works for a hedge fund. The hedge fund, under his direction, took a big position of General Motors stock. It is now demanding that General Motors use that cash to buy back its own shares so that those investors can see a rapid gain in their position. Is that sickening or what?
It is, indeed, and it reminds me a lot of what happens with the banks when they're bailed out. I mean, they, too, are pursuing profits, and they're not making loans to small and medium-sized businesses because that's not very profitable. They'd rather be in the derivatives casino, which doesn't produce anything. All it does is, you know, it's a zero-sum game, so they say, although you could question that, too.
So let's link it together, kind of the craziness in Wall Street and the process I've just described, this financial strip mining. The question that I could not, by the way, I just want to remind the listeners that the name of the book is Runaway Inequality, an activist guide to economic justice. And we actually have our own website where people can buy it with free shipping at runawayinequality.org.
Okay.
All this thanks to your guidance. You taught me how to put a book out into the market. I really appreciate that. And by the way, the profits don't go to me personally. They go back into the labor institutes so that we can promote an economic education campaign.
You don't use it to buy back your own stock.
Yeah, we don't have to buy We don't have to buy back our own stock here. I don't have to feather my own nest on this one. Okay, so the question I did not resolve in these other books I've written on finance is how's the money get to Wall Street? We talk about they have this enormous casino, but how's the money get into the casino? Whose money are they playing with? Where does it come from? And yes, as you've written eloquently about the way banks can literally create their own money, but there's another aspect to it that this process of working on runaway inequality got me to see. This financial strip mining was so effective that by 2006, 40% of all corporate profits, 40% ended up on Wall Street, even though Wall Street only has 5% of the workforce. That's the kind of transfer that took place. They literally had a suction hose inside these companies. It comes out in terms of the stock buybacks. It comes out in terms of fees for putting all these big loan packages together to buy up these companies and indebting them. By the way, there was virtually no corporate debt in the 1970s, and now it's, you know, multi-trillion dollars, which, by the way, the interest of which is tax deductible, which has a big impact on the public sector. We can get to that in a while, too. Then you have your dividends and you have your stock buybacks. So this enormous flow of money leaves the company and it ends up on Wall Street. So the funny money to play in the casino, in fact, is the strip mine money that, and this is the killer. I have this PowerPoint that I do. I take two charts from the book and I put them side by side. There's this chart that shows this huge gap forming. Wages stay flat from like 1977 on, and productivity keeps going up. So you have two lines together, and then they split. Together from rising from 47 to 1977, then they split apart. One goes flat, the other keeps going up. Well, if you take a look at wages in the financial sector versus the non-financial sector, it's an astounding chart because it looks exactly the same. From 1947 to 1980, there was no premium from working on Wall Street. Depending on your level of experience, education, skill, whether you worked at General Motors or Citibank, I guess it was called back then, or Chase Manhattan, it didn't matter. There was just no premium. Then after 1980, after the deregulation kicked in, the dirty little secret kicked in, and all this financial strip mining took place, wages go straight up. The slope is almost identical to the slope of productivity. Wages in the non-financial sector stay flat, go flat. The two charts look the same. And if you superimpose on that the third chart, which is runaway inequality, the wage gap between the top 100 CEOs and the average worker looks the same. So the money, the strip mining process was incredibly efficient. It started very early, started before they even thought of derivatives. As soon as they started deregulating, the strip mining process began because the stock manipulation began.
So all the profits from efficiencies of scale, et cetera, all went to the financialization and the shareholders.
Well, yeah, and it got there via the squeeze on the most vital functions of a corporation. You know, we cite these articles from Wall Street Journal, of all places, in the book, and they're talking about the pharmaceutical industry, which, as you know, there have been a lot of mergers and buyouts and hedge fund activity pressuring these companies to release their cash flow and move it into the CEOs and the financial investors' pockets. And the article was about the impact of this, not on workers, that's the Wall Street Journal, I don't care about the workers, but it was on research and development. And they're saying how the pharmaceutical industry has basically given up on key research and development. They've reduced their R&D budgets. And what they do now is to get a new product, they'll buy somebody else's, you know, some small company that's working on it, they'll buy them out. They don't try to produce like Alzheimer's cures and cancer cures. They don't work on that very much anymore. It's too expensive because they want the cash flow to go up to the CEO and out to the corporate raider. It's
wow.
Astounding. So this siphoning comes at the expense of R&D and the expense of workers. The idea of retaining and reinvesting in your workforce went out the window starting in the early 1980s. I work with a lot of trade unions. I don't know anybody that's getting a raise. Everybody's just trying to hang on to what they have. It's like this incredible downward pressure from these incredible profitable companies. How are they doing that? Well, they're doing billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in stock buybacks while they're demanding that workers give up some of their, you know, pay a higher copay, get less in their pension funds, and so on. And that's in a union situation. You can imagine what's going on in a non-union situation where they just change the terms of employment at will. So it's a very bad process, and there's going to be hell to pay. And the impact on the rest of society outside the company is also severe. Two things happen when you have runaway inequality. One is this incredible indebtedness of the corporation means that that money that goes to interest payment is a deduction against taxes, just the way home interest payments are a deduction against income taxes. So corporations, there's been a downward slide in corporate tax contributions, especially at the state and local level. So more pressure on the individual taxpayer because corporations are paying less and less mm-hmm. each year as a percent. Next phenomena that was recently reported in the New York Times, when people get super, super rich, they also stop paying taxes. They just move their money offshore. Right now, there's approximately $21 trillion parked offshore. That's a lot of money, $21
trillion. Wow.
And there's a whole Wall Street industry to help the super rich move their money overseas and come up with incredibly clever little complicated tax structures. So the tax contributions from the super rich has gone down. We estimate something like $150 to $200 billion a year is being lost just from individual income taxes that are parked overseas. So that's created a puzzle. How
so
can the rich
like
country?
Nearly half of income taxes, right?
Yeah.
They're like half.
Think about it.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Try this out. My son kind of started me on this course by when he was walking around New York and seeing all these homeless people on the street, and he was like, you know, just starting college, and he was kind of freaked out about this. He goes, what's going on here? I thought we were this rich country. Well, yeah, how come the richest country in the world can't afford a social safety net, can't afford to repair its infrastructure, can't afford a decent educational system? How is that possible? Well, how can we have a fiscal crisis when we have all this money? Well, the people with all the money aren't paying taxes. So the burden is put on the rest of us, and we actually now have a regressive tax system on the state and local level. When you add up all the taxes, the lower you are in the income ladder, the more you pay as a percentage of your income. The top 1% pay half the state and local taxes as a percent as the bottom 20%. And it's a perfectly graduated regressive income tax, exactly the opposite of what we're told we have. We don't have progressive taxes. We have regressive taxes. So that puts a lot of pressure on state and local government. And the consequences are severe. Two, I would like to point out. One is that, you know, higher education used to be free in this country, in New York and California, everywhere else, big state schools. I'm talking about public colleges and universities. If you had a summer job, you could probably cover the tuition. The tuition was very low at University of Wisconsin, Michigan, all schools, Big Ten schools, and others. Now, of course, there was virtually no student debt before the late 70s, and now it's a $1 trillion industry. So rather than invest in education, we've let the money be siphoned off onto Wall Street, and now students and their families have to pay for higher education. Higher education is virtually free in most of Europe, especially Northern Europe, where it is free. Not here. Okay. Second thing is, the prison population in the United States was virtually steady from 1920 to 1980 as a percent of the population. And that was during, you know, times of upheaval during the 60s and all the campus upheaval and the sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the revolts in the inner cities and all that. It was still even. Starting in 1980, the line goes up. It goes up and has the same shape and slope as runaway inequality. Today, we have the most prisoners in the world in absolute number and in a ratio of the population, bigger than China, bigger than Russia, as a percent, bigger than North Korea, bigger than Cuba. It's unbelievable. We are the largest police state in the entire world. How did that happen? Well, obviously, there were changes in drug laws, et cetera. But if you step back and look at a macro picture, we gave up on the social safety net. We gave up on the war on poverty, the development of public jobs, if necessary, for people who were unemployed, especially in rural pockets of poverty and in inner-city poverty, where the unemployment today for inner-city youth is 50% for teenagers, high school graduates, 50%. This was something we were attacking with a vengeance, sometimes with good programs, sometimes not so good programs, but we were trying in the 60s and early 70s, and we've given up. It's now, if you want a job, go find it. If you want a poverty program, go to jail. Think about it for a second. Eric Garner, the gentleman who was selling loose cigarettes and got killed in Staten Island, near the Staten Island Ferry, by the police. They're arresting him. What was he doing? He was working. This was his anti-poverty program, selling loose cigarettes on the street. He would have ended up in jail had he not been killed on his way to jail. So what we have are people being vacuumed up into the criminal justice system that should be, by the way, the unemployment rate would be a minimum of 2% higher if the prison population hadn't jumped. So we've taken the surplus, quote-unquote surplus population, put them into prison. So this is a pretty big impact of runaway inequality, and we have to do something about it in a very, very fundamental way. And I'm ready to talk about solutions.
Okay.
Okay.
So what do you propose?
I'm going to propose two categories of solutions. One on the policy side and one on the organizing side. Let me start with the policy side because much of what I've learned here, I've learned from you, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the big things we have to do is public banking. At your suggestion, I did an investigation of the Bank of North Dakota, which is, by the way, the most profitable bank in the country. And, I want to share with you a very interesting factoid here. Bank of North Dakota, the CEO earns $260,000 a year, entry-level worker about $30,000-$35,000 a year for a ratio of 8-1. By the way, average bank, top banker in New York City spends that much on his cook. You know, makes $30 million a year, not $260,000. Well, that ratio of 8-1 in the Bank of North Dakota, when you poll the American people and you ask them what they want the ratio to be, a strong Democrat says 5-1, a strong Republican says 12-1, for an average of 7-8-1. Precisely what the Bank of North Dakota does.
Mm-hmm. That's
profits,
what they
of course,
have in Japan, I think, in other countries.
Most countries have a much smaller ratio. We lead the world in runaway inequality by far. We also lead the world. We're second to last in childhood poverty amongst the developed nations. Only Romania has more than we do. But back to the Bank of North Dakota, as you know, they have loan programs where for every $100,000 they loan out, they demand that a business generate one new job in the state of North Dakota. If this was done nationally, if we had 49 other state banks, it would produce approximately, on a per capita basis, 10 million new jobs in America. And, you know, I don't have to tell you all the benefits that could come from public banking, but the big one is we could really compete with Wall Street. We don't need 50 state banks. Right now, when we pay our taxes in New Jersey, I write a check to the Department of Finance, State of New Jersey. Where's the money go? It goes into a Wall Street bank that does cash management. It goes into large banks all over the country in 49 states except in North Dakota, where tax money goes into the Bank of North Dakota, helps form its capital base. And thanks to your work and your colleagues, we've got conversations on public banking going on in, 20, 25 states and localities?
Yeah, quite a few. That's 20 states, and then there are a number of cities all over the country.
So this has to happen in a bigger way. And, of course, we should use the post office. Bernie Sanders is talking about this. That should become a public bank. I would say, half or more of the European countries use their post office as a public bank? And you've mentioned that I think 40% of the world's banking is done through public banks. And
it was in the 1990s. I guess they've privatized a few of those since.
Anyway, so public banking, I think, is the wave of the future, and it can be very competitive, as the Bank of North Dakota shows. They're more profitable than a Wall Street bank because they didn't lose any money playing in the derivatives casino or any.
They also have a more efficient model because they have lower costs in general. They don't Of course they don't pay high paid CEOs. They don't have all those stock buybacks.
So while someone like Bernie Sanders talks about breaking up with the big banks, that's not enough. Breaking up the big banks is you turn a $1 trillion bank into a $400 billion bank is not going to solve the problem. You need to have a rival banking system. And eventually, as you point out, that banking system should become the governors of the Fed. And then we'd have policies that would be much more friendly to the population of the United States as opposed to the banking community. So that's an enormous assault on Wall Street. Another one, which I know you're familiar with, can kill several birds with one stone, is the financial transaction tax or financial speculation tax or Robin Hood tax. It goes by all those names. It's a very small tax on a sales tax. Basically on Wall Street products, on their sales of stocks, bonds, and derivatives. Very, very small tax can generate $150 to $300 billion a year. And then that does something very important. It moves money back, the financial strip mine money moves back from Wall Street back into the real economy. We could use that money to provide, part of it anyway, to provide free higher education at every public college and university in this country and basically eliminate the student debt problem. So that would be a huge bonus. And Bernie Sanders is now advocating that proposal. I wish he got it from me, but I know you and I talked about this, you know, 6-7 years ago when I wrote about it on Huffington Post. So I think that's a proposal whose time has come. And the SEC rule change. Stock buybacks? No. That's stock manipulation. Just change the rule back, and it would eliminate that in a hurry. And that would put a big dent into financial strip mining. So these are just a few proposals. You're raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. There's a whole bunch listed in the book, but these are some of the key ones. But I want to get to the organizing side because I think that's where you and I and others really have to kind of lead the way. The last major effort to tame Wall Street took place in the late 1800s in the populist movement. And they were furious at what Wall Street was doing, you know, the tight money. There was no Fed, right? So the government was Wall Street when it came to the money supply. And they were basically, prices of products were going down, the loans stayed the same, so farmer after farmer was going under. And so they were absolutely livid. And they put together a platform calling for, you know, public ownership of the railroads and telegraph and telephone and co-ops and public banks. The way they did it, though, was very interesting. They fielded 6,000 educators that went around and explained to people how the economy was structured. 6,000. Today, we would need about 30,000 to do the same thing. And I think we need to build that kind of educational infrastructure. That's what this book is dedicated to. Working with, actually this coming weekend, I'm doing the first train-the-trainer with a group of union and community activists that are being sponsored by the Communications Workers of America and Citizen Action New York. And they're going to go out and train people, day-long classes they're going to do on runaway inequality. I mean, it's very heartening, assuming
wow,
we can pull
that's
this off.
Great. We'll definitely join you in that if you want
well,
to.
Well, yeah, actually, the union's putting aside a considerable amount of funds so they can take 1,000 people out of work over the next 2 years
mm-hmm.
nationally to have
wow.
them trained and to build an anti-financialization campaign, to lead one mm-hmm. with many, many partners, which I know you're going to be in the middle of. Actually, I've added public banking to their platform because they hadn't really heard of it. I said, well, you got to read Ellen Brown if you want to learn about what's going on here. And they looked at your stuff and they put it on their agenda. So you're having an impact. And I think we, the anti-financial, anti-Wall Street educators, have got to get our stuff out, which you're doing. And we have to form a broad alliance to do what the populace did. I can't build the movement structure. I'm too old. I don't have the energy that the young organizers have. But I think that's coming. I think there's two examples we have, actually three, that are heartening. First, we had Occupy Wall Street. As you recall, before Occupy Wall Street, the discussion that summer of 2010 was in the Obama administration with Congress about the grand compromise to cut Social Security and to tighten everybody's belt. Austerity was in the air. Occupy Wall Street hit. In a matter of months, there were 900 encampments, and the whole conversation changed. We are the 99%, and inequality was put on the map. And they tapped a raw nerve, a raw anti-Wall Street nerve, like never before. Unfortunately, they were poorly organized in terms of staying power. So in 6 months, they were gone because they believed in spontaneous combustion, that somehow these things would just fire up and build on its own through the Internet, et cetera. And I think we know better. As the populace knew, you got to organize. You have to actually build a structure, a common agenda, and have us all belong to something. Well, the next thing that happened was Elizabeth Warren comes out of nowhere, and she also gains a terrific following for her anti-Wall Street work, which I believe she's also, I think, a fan of yours. If she isn't, she will be. She's gained quite a following both across the country. And then the third example is the Bernie Sanders campaign. I wrote this book without knowing he was going to run. I never dreamed that he was going to run, and I never thought it would amount to much if he did run, frankly. And we're kind of echoing each other. The book sounds like his speeches and vice versa to some extent. Many points overlap. And he's taken off. Why? Because he's tapped into that same nerve. Mm-hmm. The question now becomes, and this is the organizational question, I think, of our time, which is what happens after the campaign, win or lose? What happens to those 2 million small donors? What happens to the tens of thousands of volunteers that are going to be in that campaign? What happens afterwards? Is a structure going to be built, or are we going to go back to our normal chaotic silos? And as you mentioned at the very beginning, I think one of the problems we have is that the way the progressive movement is organized is in a series of silos based on their funding sources. So you have environment, education, racial justice, identities, gay and lesbian rights, gay marriage, housing, on and on and on, like 101 different issues. And what ties them all together is runaway inequality. I show that in the book. I go through issue after issue and show the impact of runaway inequality on these issues. We need to come together. We were asleep at the switch when the crash happened in 2007. These organizations did not respond. The right did with the Tea Party, but progressives did not respond to the crash. We just continued to work in our silos. And Occupy Wall Street did not come from the silos. It came out of basically nowhere. It came out of a little group called Adbusters, put out a notice, and people came running. So we have to change that structure. We have to break through these silos, make them porous, has incredible amount of talent in it. Your silo is not a silo. You're not a silo. You're virtually self-funded, and you've been telling it like it is because you're saying, hey, we all have to get behind public banking or we're screwed. Well, yeah, that has to be one of the key issues on a common agenda that has, 5 or 10 points that we all know have to happen to tackle runaway inequality. American people are ready for this. They want to join something that's going to take on these incredible injustices. So I'm trying to help build that, as you are, I'm trying to help build that educational infrastructure. I can't build the movement, but I can help build the educational infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we're having some good luck on this. We're able to move 20,000 copies before the book even hit the bookstores and mm-hmm. Amazon, et cetera. Yeah, because unions and community groups have bought up mass copies for their members because they see that they need this education. So now we need to create the educators to go with it. The book's designed so at the end of every chapter, there are discussion questions. People can use it for book clubs, study groups, self-study, college courses, high school courses, and we're trying to get the word out. I'm trying to get on public radio stations, on programs like yours, to spread the word. And the correspondence I'm getting, I know you get the same thing. It's very heartening, right? People send you letters like, this is great. I've read the book. I really, really find it valuable. How can I participate? How can I help out? And that's what we need the structure for.
That's what makes this work rewarding.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So how can I help? I want to participate. I just got a note today from a retired teacher. I'd love to come to some workshops. I'd like to contribute in any way I can. It's like people want to do something. They want to build a country based on principles of fairness.
Yeah, the people are ready. They just need something to bring them together.
Yeah, I want to join something.
This is very exciting.
That has state, local, and national chapters. I said this about Occupy Wall Street. I said it right when it was happening. I said, look, I'm not going to go sleep on the concrete. I'm in my 60s. I'm not going to sleep out in the street, especially as it gets colder. But there were a million people, I would guess, in the New York area, a million that wanted to do something to help out. But there was nobody around to say, hey, you can join this, and this is what we're going to do. There was no agenda, no organization. There was so much money donated to Occupy Wall Street, they didn't know what to do with it. I mean, people wanted to contribute and help out, but they didn't have a way to do it. So that's, we have to build a structure. Spontaneous combustion does not build a movement. It can flash up every now and then and do very important things, but we need to build something to sustain itself. So the organizing side, I think in this case, is important as the policy side.
I totally agree.
Distortions,
yeah.
Right? Between money
and
politics. Yeah, it's exciting, and I'm so glad that you've been helping to lead the way on this.
Oh, and you. This is great. Very inspiring to me. So do you want to repeat your website?
Yes. Well, the book title is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice, and the website where you can get it directly from us is runawayinequality.org. If you want an e-book, you've got to go to the usual suppliers. That would be Amazon, Apple, and Barnes & Noble. But if you go to our website, we don't have two-day shipping, but we do have free shipping, and we have a very competitive price. And it should be at your local bookstore and on your online sellers.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Les Leopold, co-founder and director of the Labor Institute in New York City and the author of Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.